Safety, dependability, and power. Chevy Silverado isn't happy unless the work is hard and the day is long. No wonder Silverado is America's number one best-selling retail pickup truck. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and put a Silverado in your toolbox.
Hey, gang. Harry Carey here from the afterlife. And I got to tell you, folks, being dead is fantastic. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. It's like heaven.
It's like heaven or it is heaven?
Let's not get caught up in a semantics argument, Seth.
That's right. 720 WGN. John Waydegger at 10 minutes after 9, welcoming from the Chicago Tribune, Phil Rosenthal. Good evening, Phil. Thanks for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Great article. Holy cow. Harry Carey made his regular season debut as voice of the Chicago White Sox 50 years ago today. How about it? Holy cow. And, you know, ironically, although how apropos, that today is also National Beer Day. So, I mean, Harry
Carey. I wonder if that's as a result of that.
He probably consumed enough in his lifetime.
Well, he sold a lot of it, too.
Yeah. Oh, did he always sell Bud, or did he in his travels?
No. I mean, there was when he was with in St. Louis for a time, it was Bud. Yeah. But when he did Browns games, I think Greasy Dick was another one. He did Falstaff here in Chicago for a time. There were a lot of different beers over the years, but so much of his legacy is now tied up in what he did at the very end of his career, and that obviously was with Budweiser.
Right, and I think you hit the nail on the head that his legacy revolves around what he did later in his career. But as your article points out, a lot of things happened before that. I mean, a lot of things.
He spent 25 years in St. Louis before any of this happened, and then spent a year in Oakland, and then at 57 came to Chicago. And, you know, he was still peak Harry Carey at that point. By the end of his career, he became more of he was always entertaining, but he became more of an entertainer, I would say, and in some ways a caricature of what he once was. But you know, in the main, it's an amazing career any way you cut it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, not just the baseball part of it, but as you alluded to, the celebrity, the personality, the character. I mean, taking your shirt off, sitting out in the bleachers, doing play-by-play. I mean, that's classic stuff.
Yeah, and you know, even before Howard Cosell really made this a phrase, he really told it like it was for a long time. Yeah. He wasn't always fair about it necessarily.
Right.
He wasn't always right either. But this is a guy who, when he was in Oakland, he had Rick Monday on the pregame show and asked him straight out. He said, you know, how come you can't seem to get people in when you come up to bat with players on base? You know. That's not something people hear or necessarily take well. But that was the kind of announcer he was.
And he didn't seem to worry too much about stepping on toes of owners, other management, baseball managers, baseball players. I don't know if you would say made enemies, but he certainly...
Oh, he did.
Okay.
He did make enemies, sure. I mean, there's a great story. He made a lot of enemies. What's interesting is not everybody who was his enemy remained so. I mean, Bill Melton had a back problem when he was playing with the White Sox, and Harry just rode him and said, you know, why isn't he doing this? Why isn't he doing that? And really, in a lot of ways, drove Melton out of town. He ended up going to California after that. But, you know, Melton speaks well of him now. So it's not, you know, some of it gets smoothed over, some of it doesn't. I don't think it's an accident that there's a statue of Harry at Wrigley Field and not at Guaranteed Rate Park, though. He
yeah,
did not
that?
Necessarily yeah. leave those guys on the best of
right.
terms.
Well, this is what's so great about the article, Phil, is that you go back to times when Harry comes to town and can hardly be heard because no radio station wants to carry the games. And we'll talk about that and more with Phil Rosenthal when we come back on 720 WGN.
Hello again, everybody. Harry Carey at Wrigley Field on this noteworthy night indeed. 8-8-88. That's the date. And this bud's for you, Bill Murray.
Thank you, Harry. I've been dying under these lights until you handed me this thing.
Hey, it's such a pleasure to see you, especially on a noteworthy event like this one.
Well, I don't know how I feel about night baseball. It's great in the minor leagues, but it's someplace else to go in town besides your restaurant, which is a good thing.
You know, how's your mother, by the way?
My mother is, she's off the booze, real pretty, but she's doing really well. She's doing great.
That bit you put on when I was sick and you were on and did such a great job, the bit you did about your mother, among other things, I think it should be a special cassette. You ought to sell about 10 million of them.
There they are. Harry Carey, Bill Murray, another iconic moment in the history of Chicago baseball, the first night game at Wrigley Field. Phil Rosenthal is with us, who wrote a great article about Harry Carey's 50th anniversary of being a announcer for the White Sox, and obviously that's one of the events that occurred with the Cubs. And, you know, Phil, when you think about the amount of money that Major League Baseball makes from television revenue, ad revenue, the amount of money that players make, the way that that sport just dominates the media now, your article takes it back to when that was not the case. You're talking this is incredible. Carey comes to town and you can't even hear him.
Yeah, the White Sox were a struggling franchise. You got to remember, the 1970s season, this one before this, they lost 106 games. And that was they were the worst team in the American League, and that was with expansion teams in the league. So this is not a good sign. They drew less than 500,000 fans to Comiskey Park. WMAQ, the 50,000-watt station in town, dropped them. You know, this is the end of the road. Bob Elson, who had been their announcers, well, he'd done their games going back all the way to 1931, but had been their primary announcer since 46, leaves to go and replace Carey in Oakland with Red Rush. So Harry's coming into a sort of a disaster area here. And they can't match the amount of money that he was making in Oakland. I don't know whether he actually was, but he told people he was making about $80,000 at the time. The White Sox said, we can pay you $50,000. He said, well, how about you give me the $50,000? I'll take a bonus for every, and he ended up with a deal where for every 100,000 fans they got over 600,000, he got another $10,000. And that was the deal. They ended up drawing more than 800,000. So he made 70,000, which is the equivalent of about $450,000 today.
That was big money.
But the really amazing thing is that he was hired without having WMAQ. And, you know, this is a guy who did 50,000 watts in St. Louis at KMOX. It was heard across a good chunk of the country. I mean, Elvis was a fan in Memphis because he could get the games there. And you know, WMEQ was like that, a clear channel station you could get over a huge swath of North America. He says he's on a sort of a thrown-together network of five stations. Four of them are FM. And you got to remember, in 1971, I don't have to tell you, there were not a lot of FM radios in cars, which is, you know, that's going to cut into your, or even homes, really, for that matter, of a certain age. So this was a problem. The one AM station was in LaGrange, and it was a 5,000-watt station. Except that at night, when the White Sox play most of their games, they had to drop down to 500 watts. So this was not a radio. He had to fight for every listener he had. Zenith was a sponsor of White Sox radio at the time, and they gave away radios to people who were on, I think, the post-game show.
And that makes sense.
And it said that he told one of the people, at least one of the people, though knowing Harry, he probably said it a lot, you're going to, you know, for being our guest on tonight's postgame show, you're going to get a Zenith radio. Good luck getting our games on it. So you can see this was the challenge he faced. But, you know, in 2 years, they were popular enough and drew a pretty good sized audience despite that handicap. Enough that they could get WMAQ back in the fold. But by 73, he'd moved primarily over to TV when they had switched from channel 32 to channel 44. And again, it was a lower, again, it was a lower signal, and he had all kinds of trouble with that. So it was never easy being the White Sox announcer.
Now, a part of your article says you're talking, I hope I'm reading this correctly, this little ad hoc network that you're talking about of four FMs and one AM, they paid, if I got this right, the station was paid by the Sox $25 a game?
Time. Yeah, the team had, they spent about $25,000 over the course of the season paying for, to put the games on the radio, and then the White Sox sold the advertising and kept that money. But that gives you an idea. They were buying time on these stations. Sometimes teams will do that. But $25, even in 1971 dollars, is not huge money.
I can't. It's just, well, the idea of what it's all worth now, it's insane to think
that. Yeah, but you know, the players weren't making that kind of money then either.
True.
I mean,
I know.
This was at the time Curt Flood was fighting for free agency and losing. Yeah. And that was another guy that Harry wrote. He didn't understand why Curt Flood wouldn't want to take the money and go. You know, he's getting paid so much money in this day and age when working men and women were not making that much. He thought that was terrible. But, you know, history kind of looks at that a little differently.
The article that you wrote in the Tribune, which everybody should take a look at, it's just great. You're talking about in this particular paragraph when Bill Veeck bought the team and brought Harry back. As a matter of fact, I mentioned earlier, we did a promotion with the White Sox and the Bay City Rollers. And the Bay City, we went down to Comiskey with the Bay City Rollers, and then they went somewhere to do a concert, and I did a half an inning with Harry on Channel 44. And I had my two young daughters with me, and Mary Frances Veeck was the babysitter. And Harry was, you know, Harry was Harry. What can I say? I really didn't know that much about what I was doing as trying to be a color commentator to Harry Carey's play-by-play. But, you know, I got a picture out of it, so I've always got that as a memento to be with Harry.
Being a color commentator for Harry was not always easy, because when Harry wanted to talk, Harry wanted to talk, and he didn't necessarily want it to be a conversation.
Right.
So he went through a lot of commentators. There were some he got along with just fine, and then there were some he couldn't get rid of fast enough. You know, and that was not just true in Chicago. That was true everywhere. In Oakland, for example, one of the problems he had with Charlie Finley was he'd had Denny McLain on a pregame show, and he sort of prompted Denny to tee off on how Finley was treating players. And before he got up to the booth, Monty Moore, who was his broadcast partner, had called Charles Finley back in, I think he was living in Chicago or Gary or something, and ratted him out. And so Carey had to answer the phone and get reamed out by Charlie. You know, some guys did not like working with him. Some wanted them to like him, and it never quite clicked. So when he found someone like Steve Stone or Jimmy Pearsall, it was really a wonderful thing.
I hope I'm reading, you know, I've said this before, but
you say this. I'm guessing if you didn't read it right, I didn't write it right.
I'm just making sure that I've interpreted it. No one sang "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" in the seventh inning until he and Nancy Faust started it?
Well, people did it, but nobody sang it over the public address.
Ah, gotcha. Okay.
You know, he led. It became an event, really.
Right. Oh, no.
Where he would lead them in singing. And it was something that Bill Veeck had wanted to do for years at his ballparks, whether he owned the Browns or the Indians or the White Sox. But he needed the right person, and Harry was someone who he would sing it anyway a little bit, you know, as Nancy played it. But putting him over the public address system, Bill felt it would encourage others to join in and make it a real event. And let's face it, there's just not a lot of places where you get that kind of group singing. So, you know, this and the fact that it lives on as an event at Wrigley Field, but it lives on at White Sox games and other places as well. And I think he elevated it in that way.
He sure did. Well, Phil, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate it. Phil Rosenthal from the Chicago Tribune on the 50th anniversary of Harry Carey calling his first White Sox game.